Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who talks about her moral and legal objections to the Obama administration's drone program when it comes to killing U.S. citizens or anyone else. Isaiah Poole of the Campaign for America's Future, who discusses the significance of a February 8th protest in North Carolina, the largest civil rights demonstration in the South since the 1965 march from Selma to Montgomery. And Jill Guidera, field organizing coordinator with the group Transportation Alternatives in New York City, who describes some of the advocacy campaigns her group works on. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Typhoon Haiyan tore across the central Philippines last November, killing over 6,000 people and destroying over a million homes in an area the size of the state of Maine. Now, subsistence farmers and fishermen are struggling to survive. In the wake of an influx of international emergency aid from humanitarian groups, the work of rebuilding basic infrastructure has created opportunities for enterprising Filipinos to start new ventures and learn new skills. After Typhoon Haiyan, the British-based aid group Oxfam sought to empower local citizens as they provided resources to build sanitary services. Instead of building new latrines, Oxfam organized workshops on the benefits of good sanitation. Then the group offered funds to pay for local masons and carpenters to build the latrines. Oxfam also donated chainsaws to a farmers' cooperative to clear away thousands of downed coconut palm trees. In the process, farmers got paid for the tree removal, enabling them to buy rice seed, and the lumber was sold to NGOs to be used in reconstruction projects. Farm workers in California's Central Valley are nervously waiting for the new planting season, as a record drought and political pressure by agribusiness is putting livelihoods at risk. Farm workers in places like Mendota, California, are fearful they could soon be out of work. In a city known as the Cantaloupe Capital of the World, a community already burdened with a 40% poverty rate. Work generally begins to pick up in March. However, there is growing concern that farmers will opt not to plant crops this spring due to the imposition of statewide water restrictions. In mid-January, California Governor Jerry Brown declared a statewide drought emergency. Meanwhile, national and state Republicans blamed water restrictions in the state's Central Valley on federal environmental rules protecting threatened fish species, specifically the endangered Delta smelt. GOP House Speaker John Boehner supported a bill that would boost water flows to Central Valley farmers and override species protection laws. On a recent visit to California, President Obama pledged $183 million in short-term relief for farmers and blamed the drought and other extreme weather events on climate change. The president also called on Congress to pass a billion-dollar climate resiliency program to fund research, development, and new infrastructure to prepare for climate disasters. When former Republican Florida Governor Charlie Crist appeared on Bill Maher's real-time cable program on February 9th, he blasted the 50-year economic embargo against Cuba as counterproductive and harmful to the Florida economy. Crist, who is now running as a Democrat to unseat incumbent Florida Governor Rick Scott, declared that the embargo has done nothing in 50 years to change the regime in Cuba. Both Governor Scott, a conservative Republican, and Florida's Cuban-American establishment attacked Crist for flip-flopping on Cuba policy, citing the former governor's public support for the embargo as recently as 2010. After his appearance on the Bill Maher Show, Crist sent out a statement saying, "If we want to bring democracy to Cuba, we need to encourage American values and investment there and not cede influence to China." Crist's critique of the Cuba embargo is now shared by a majority in the U.S., especially in Florida. A new poll released in mid-February by the Atlantic Council found 56% of Americans surveyed favor engagement with Cuba, while 63% of Florida residents support improved relations with Havana. Among Cuban Americans living in Florida, 79% of those polled favor normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
According to recent press reports, the Obama administration is considering assassinating a U.S. citizen living abroad by drone strike for his alleged involvement in terrorist activity with Al-Qaeda. An Associated Press article quoted U.S. officials saying that the unidentified man was responsible for coordinating attacks against Americans overseas and continues to plan new attacks using improvised explosive devices. If carried out, this would be the fifth known assassination of a U.S. citizen under the Obama presidency. The report further stated that administration officials say the suspected American terrorist is living in a country that bars U.S. military action on its territory and that the nation's government has been unable or unwilling to detain this individual. Under President Obama's new policies governing the use of drones overseas, announced on May 23rd last year, lethal force must only be used to prevent or stop attacks against U.S. persons, and even then, only when capture is not feasible and no other reasonable alternatives exist to address the threat effectively. The directive goes on to say that the target must also pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons, the legal definition of catching someone in the act of plotting a lethal attack. Although there has been growing criticism of the civilian casualties resulting from Washington's use of drone strikes to attack suspected terrorists abroad, some conservative politicians oppose President Obama's new guidelines. Republican Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said, quote, "Individuals who would have been previously removed from the battlefield by U.S. counterterrorism operations for attacking or plotting to attack against U.S. interests remained free because of self-imposed red tape." Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author of the book Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Here she talks about her moral and legal objections to the Obama administration's drone program when it comes to killing U.S. citizens or anyone else.
I think it's horrible that the U.S. even contemplates killing U.S. citizens with drone attacks. It means that people like the one being contemplated killing have not even been charged, and the U.S. government says that it would be too difficult to try to capture this person, and yet it's hard to know if that is really true because so many people have been killed in these drone strikes that could have been captured. And it is important to talk about individual U.S. citizens, but I think it's important, Scott, that we put it in the context of this larger drone program of killing people that are non-U.S. citizens. And I think that according to international law, they all deserve the right to be able to surrender. You can't surrender to a drone. They should be charged and, if feasible, should be captured. And there is supposed to be some public acknowledgement of efforts that have been made or why it's impossible to capture somebody. And the U.S. has not been doing that at all with this drone program.
Medea, does the public's attention to the possibility the U.S. government may be on the verge of assassinating a U.S. citizen, is that somehow an opening to challenge these policies, not just for U.S. citizens, as you said, but for all the other innocent victims that are killed in these drone strikes?
Yes, I think it's a time for us to try to get dialogue going in the American public about what drone assassinations are all about and how it is such a distortion of the rule of law. If you look at the rule of law, Scott, it says that there has to be an imminent danger, which means that there is an attack about to happen. I don't think the U.S. government could say that this American citizen is about to do something to kill other Americans. It's more that they might, and we don't know when, we don't know how they might be involved. And that's not what an imminent attack is all about. And I think it is important to try to keep finding these ways that we can get the discussion going among the American public about what if another country was doing this to us? What if the Russians were using a drone to kill perhaps a very evil Russian citizen who was living in the United States? Would we allow that to happen? No, we wouldn't allow it. And so why should other countries allow that to happen? Pakistanis, whether it's a U.S. citizen or not, have been saying that they are against the drone program, from the prime minister to the legislature to the Pakistani people in every single poll that's been taken, and that yet the U.S. ignores the wishes and the sovereignty of other nations.
Medea, in terms of the drone strikes, one thing that's disturbing to you and many opponents of the U.S. drone warfare program is the fact that the inner circle of the White House, the president in particular, turns out to be the judge, jury, and executioner in terms of who lives and who dies under the reign of these drone missiles and bombs. That means any future president will obviously have the same power. How important is it that this whole program is reformed and the power, the concentrated power, be challenged before another president takes office?
Well, I think one of the scariest things to me in researching the drone program has been the lack of oversight from Congress. We are supposed to have checks and balances in this country, and the legislative branch is an important check on executive power. That's why the Founding Fathers made the legislative branch the one that's supposed to declare war, because it was so much easier for one individual to get angry and say, okay, I'm going to go to war. And yet, because Obama is a Democrat, the Democratic Party, and especially the progressives within the Democratic Party, who would normally play the role of our allies in this, have been incredibly silent, with the exception of just a few of them. And so it means that the executive has been able to usurp the power of the legislature. The legislature has gone along with this. We have people like Dianne Feinstein in the Intelligence Committee that thinks that this program is just fine. And so it is very scary. And for those people who continue to put their faith in President Obama and say, well, he's a good guy, I trust what he's doing, as you implied, Scott, what happens when this amazing power of life and death is now given into the hands of the next president and the next president? And what happens when there are drones that have been okayed to be flying in U.S. airspace, which is going to be coming by next year, and those drones start to be weaponized, and they have the ability to kill people right here in the United States with the press of a button? I think we better be very concerned about it now, because this is otherwise our future.
That was Code Pink Women for Peace co-founder Medea Benjamin, author of the book Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Learn more about groups opposing the U.S. drone warfare program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. February 8th witnessed the largest civil rights gathering in the South since the 1965 Selma to Montgomery March in Alabama. The march and rally of 80,000 people at North Carolina's capital in Raleigh was organized to respond to the extremist policies of North Carolina's Republican Party, which since 2010 controls the governor's seat and the state legislature for the first time since 1896. Among the issues that brought a broad coalition of groups and tens of thousands of activists together from North Carolina and 42 other states was the passage of one of the nation's harshest voter suppression laws, new anti-abortion regulations, the cutoff of unemployment benefits to 170,000 state residents, rejection of federal funding to expand Medicaid coverage to 500,000 working poor families under the Affordable Care Act, and an increase in taxes on North Carolina's low-income residents while lowering the tax burden on the state's wealthiest citizens. The primary organizer of the march was the Reverend William J. Barber, president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, who has built a growing grassroots movement by staging Moral Monday protests and engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience actions at the state capitol since April 2013. Your reporter spoke with Isaiah Poole, Campaign for America's Future blog editor and director of the group's online communications. Here he talks about his recent article, A March in North Carolina for the Soul of America, describing the significance of the February 8th march and the broader issues relating to the agenda of today's progressive movement.
It of course, starts with the takeover of the state by the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, the arch-conservative wing. They won total control of the state legislature. and began to immediately enact a series of very draconian laws that restricted voting rights, cut funding to public education, limited a woman's right to access to abortion services. They rejected Medicaid funding for that they would have received under Obamacare, which meant that hundreds of thousands of low-income citizens of the state would not get access to health care. It was very sweeping, and the result of that, the reaction to that, was a series of demonstrations that were organized by Reverend William Barber, who's the head of the North Carolina NAACP, that were done at the state capitol in Raleigh on Mondays when the legislature was in session. And these rallies began to build over time, and women's rights groups, lesbian and gay rights groups, labor, environmental organizations, all of these groups came together every Monday and marched. Reverend William Barber insisted that the march not be a partisan event, but it is but a march, a series of demonstrations based on the morality or the immorality of what the state was doing to its citizens. And the culmination of that was this event on February 8th that, as you said, according to the organizers, attracted about 80,000 people, with the hope that it would not only add momentum to what has been happening in North Carolina, sort of the push back against this extremist right-wing agenda, but would also energize movements in Georgia, in South Carolina, and in other states around the country.
Isaiah, I wanted to ask you this question. What are the lessons that you see in this vibrant, exciting, new civil rights and social rights, economic justice movement in North Carolina for the rest of the country?
One thing, first of all, when you Reverend Barber is right to say that this is not about a, you know, which political machine wins. This is much bigger than that. It is about what kind of America do we want for our children, and do we want an America where only a handful of people succeed, or do we want an America in which everyone succeeds and has the possibility of succeeding and has a stake and is rewarded for the work that they put into America? Right now, we have millions of people who are working harder than ever, and yet they are earning less. The middle class has been decimated, even though they're putting in more hours. They're, you know, we have people who, if you can get a job, some of us are working two and three jobs just to barely make ends meet. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the America that we want, or do we want the America in which work is rewarded, people are treated with dignity, that we respect the value of each and every human being, and that the systems that we create embody those principles?
Isaiah, tell us a little bit about Reverend William Barber. What's his profile? How has he been so successful in organizing such a powerful coalition inside North Carolina and attracting people from all over the country to his movement? There have been comparisons made to the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm not sure that is something that you hold to, but tell us about Reverend Barber, the head of the North Carolina NAACP.
He is incredibly dynamic. He is very smart. I think the comparison to Martin Luther King, although it sounds kind of outlandish, I think actually in terms of the rhetorical gift that he has and the ability to frame social issues in religious terms, I think it's very similar. I mean, he comes out of that tradition. of theology that connects the progressive social imperative to the gospel. I think that what he has done, I think, is given us the picture of a person of faith who is very deeply connected to the plight of ordinary people and is very committed to the idea that all people are children of God, regardless of their race or their gender or their sexual orientation or the faith that they adhere to, that we all have value, and he's very committed to reflecting that in everything that he does. And I think that that's a very important key to his success.
That was Isaiah Poole, Campaign for America's future blog editor and director of the group's online communications. Find links to news and analysis about North Carolina's Moral Monday protest movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The annual National Youth Bike Summit took place at the New School University in New York City, February 14th through the 16th. There, hundreds of teens, young adults, and older supporters came together to hear a keynote speaker, an African-American bike racer, to attend workshops, create bike-themed clothing and jewelry, and more importantly, to network and learn from each other. One of the activities at the summit was a political action center, which guided participants through the steps necessary to organize their own campaign for better transportation. The Political Action Workshop was sponsored by Transportation Alternatives, one of the most active transportation organizations in New York City, whose mission is to reclaim New York City streets from the automobile and advocate for bicycling, walking, and public transit as the best transportation alternatives. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Jill Guidera, Field Organizing Coordinator with Transportation Alternatives, or TA. Here she describes some of the campaigns her group works on and how they build alliances to reach out to new communities and become more effective advocates.
We organize around about 14 campaigns every year, between 2 and 4 in each borough of New York City. These campaigns are based on needs assessment and community demand from our borough-based activist committees. We then look at what their ideas are and help them formulate short-term and long-term campaigns to transform their boroughs. I work very closely to help facilitate the Bronx Activist Committee, where we are looking to see car-free Sundays reinstated on the concourse, a redesign of the Grand Concourse, as well as bike-friendly Belmont and improvements on Westchester Avenue. I also work at TA to organize our field staff, who are New York City Bike Ambassadors, and they are hourly field organizers who pound the pavement to go and make sure we have the critical support needed to see all of these campaigns happen.
And could you tell me what this workshop or opportunity is for people here at the Youth Bike Summit to do some kind of political campaigns?
Yes. This is our second year running our Political Action Center at the Youth Bike Summit. We absolutely love doing it. A lot of what I do as an organizer in New York City is talking to residents about what they want to see and then finding concrete ways to actually voice that to their decision makers, their local politicians, their community boards, to make sure they see those things happen. Doing this at the Youth Bike Summit is kind of instilling that idea that you can be the one to instigate change in your own neighborhoods. So at the Political Action Center, we're inviting youth to write down what their big ideas are. If they could change anything in their neighborhood, what would they change? It can be as big and out there or as concrete and simple as they like. And then from there, from taking this big idea, we then can offer very clear tactics that we can walk them through right here on the spot about how they would organize their community to see that happen. We actually look up their decision makers, help them formulate language to either make a petition, write a letter, or create a photo petition.
And the work that you've done, have you had successes around bike-related issues in the city?
I will say about the Bike Summit is that we make connections with people who have lasted. I don't know if you spoke with my intern, Alicia Bunting, but I actually met her last year at the Youth Bike Summit, talked to her about ideas that she wanted to see in her neighborhood in Canarsie, and she had some great ones. We shared information, and then she joined more formally our internship program. She did a really outstanding job there, and then became a part-time staffer at our organization and continues to do really great work. So it's these relationships that are built here are able to become more long-term and lasting, and then are able to open up ideas about how to be involved on a professional level on these issues.
And what about more broadly the things that TA has worked on?
TA has worked on a lot. As I mentioned, we have 14 campaigns running across New York City. In the past year, we won a great handful of campaigns. We saw better infrastructure on the approach to the 59th or Queensboro Bridge, and that was bike and pedestrian infrastructure actually installed. For example, we're doing a lot of work this year around Vision Zero, which is looking at zero traffic deaths across the city. And are organizing forums in every borough around that. And there's been a ton of momentum around that in South Brooklyn. We have community leaders on every level who are looking to host that forum in the next couple of months. And that was a campaign we worked very hard on and are seeing that success then translate across the city.
And I understand that wasn't one of the first things the new mayor, Bill de Blasio, took a stand on was Vision Zero, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a really great moment for us to see this work that we've been doing on the ground to translate into his campaign, but then also into his statements as our new mayor. So I think we're kind of in this big watershed moment to really see these things happen.
If there's any other ones you want to talk about, any different kinds of successes you've had, that would be great too.
We saw the northernmost bike infrastructure installed in New York City this past year. That's in the Bronx, running east-west across 222nd Street and into Co-op City. So several communities who had actually been isolated from the rest of the city, who didn't have calm streets and sidewalks or bike lanes to use to get around their neighborhoods and connect to the rest of the city, now had this connection. That was a big win for us. In the past year, also seeing plans for a separate bike lane on the Pulaski Bridge, which connects Queens and Brooklyn, was another big win we saw this year and helped us to grow our committees and then build that momentum towards next year.
That was Jill Guidera, Field Organizing Coordinator with Transportation Alternatives in New York City. For more information on Transportation Alternatives and the annual Youth Bike Summit, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.